We're going to start a series over the next several weeks, and we're going to study the soul. And Lord willing, we'll continue on for 3 or 4, maybe 5 weeks, study of the soul. And it actually began with a passage I was reading a couple of months back, and it's found in the third epistle of John. Third epistle of John, I'll read it unto you. It says, John's writing, and he says, "The elder unto the well-beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Behold, I wish above all things that thou may prosperous and be in health, even as thy soul prospers." And I'm starting to sit there and I read that passage. It's like, well, what does it mean for the soul to prosper? And so what I did, I started, you know, thinking about that. And then I was reading another book and it triggered another thought. And I want to ask you a question right now. And y'all just answer in your mind. If you want to answer out loud, just shout it out. That'd be fine too. But if I said, "Hey, how are you doing today? How's your health?" I think everybody have pretty good answers. Matter of fact, I actually did this for a couple of weeks just as kind of an experiment, one of my own little experiments. You go up to somebody and say, "Hey, how you doing? How's your health?" And I heard about everything from hangnails to kids got whooping cough to I'm tired, stuff like that. Then the next week, I'd go up to the same people and I'd look at them and I'd go, "How's your soul?" And I got this. 9 times out of 10, just no answer. And I'd venture to say, if somebody went up to you and said, "How's your soul?" it'd be kind of a hard question to ask, right? Eugene Peterson, as a matter of fact, he's the guy that wrote the Message Bible. He was writing about a time when he was an adolescent. He says, "I had this pastor who, when I was a teenager, would always come up to me and ask me, 'Eugene, how is your soul?' And I wouldn't know how to answer. Didn't even really know I had a soul. I knew I had hormones, and that was about it." This whole idea of soul, and if you think about it, we hadn't really studied the soul, and I think it's something that we need to do. In Jesus' day, a lot of Pharisees had really great devotional lives, but their souls were actually a mess. Eugene, in that same book, he was writing, when he was writing about the soul, he said at his church, it kind of meant, "Am I all fired up with intense emotions?" And a lot of times, churches and people can manipulate other people's emotions and then go out and lead really sinful lives. So a lot of people in our world really never ask the question at all. They say, "How are you feeling? How are you doing?" But if somebody asks about your soul, it might be kind of a hard question to answer. I might not even know. And there's actually a reason for this. Because the nature of the soul, and there's some parts of you, and I kind of utilize this board here, there's parts of you that make up who you are. And a kind of a part of your core being, and we use a little visual aid here, but kind of your core being is your will. And that's your ability to be able to make conscious decisions about yourself. And then, you know, the will is actually a subset of the mind. You have portions of your mind, but the will of certainly is a subset of it. And then a subset of that is your body. I mean, the body has the mind, has the will. And above all of that, and this is what we're going to study today, is your soul. And as we go through the Bible over the next few weeks, I think what we're going to find out is that the soul actually integrates the body, the mind, and the will. The ability to choose, your habits, your thoughts, your appetites, your feelings and things like that. So the soul is actually the deepest part of you. And it's so deep, there are parts of my soul that I cannot even understand. We are going to cover a lot of scriptures today. We have two different kind of methods of preaching. There's expository messages where you take the scriptures and you go through verse by verse by verse. But there's also another type of preaching. And it's called topical. Today we're going to do topical. We're going to study the soul, and instead of going passage by passage linearly, we're going to take a 1,000-foot view and kind of see the connectivity of all the passages as they relate together. Because what I'd like to talk to you about today is the satisfaction of the soul. So we're going to do some flipping here. And the soul, first thing I want to point out is how the soul is one of the deepest parts of you. It's so deep, as a matter of fact, and this is one of the reasons why people can't ask the question, "How's your soul doing?" The soul is deep, very deep. And when writers of the ancient world were writing, they would often address the soul in the third person. they would say things like here in Psalms, "Bless the Lord, O my soul." They'd say things like in Psalm 42:5, "Why art thou cast down, O my soul? And why art thou disquieted within me?" It's literally talking to the soul in the third person of its unique and individual parts. Now, by the way, when we think about the soul, the Bible actually speaks 20 different times about God having a soul. God says to his people in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 11, "And I set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. And I will walk among you and will be your God, and ye shall be my people." Everything that God is stands behind this promise. My soul shall not abhor you. Now, another point is that the soul has a depth to it that the word self cannot convey. So how's it going with our souls today? And biblical writers were really concerned about this. They talked a lot about this, and they constantly found themselves asking, how's my soul doing? And what we see is a chronicle pattern of how the soul is never satisfied. They were constantly yearning for something. As a matter of fact, the Hebrew word for this constant yearning is a word, nephesh, and it's used 755 times in the Old Testament alone. Nephesh. And over again, it's described as a longing or a wanting or a desiring or a striving. And so many times the word nephesh is translated as your mouth, your stomach, your throat. And the Hebrew way of expressing this is very concrete. And the Bible talks about the soul being hungry or thirsty or hollow or empty. And you find statements like this. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire, nephesh. And there's also vanity and vexation of spirit, which we all have. Genesis 34 chronicles a very bad section of history and tells about a horribly violent story of a man named Shechem who violated a woman named Dinah. And this is what it says. It says, his soul craved Dinah. His nephesh, his unsatisfied soul, craved Dinah. And his soul is not doing very well. And you know, we in our day, instead of saying cravings and desirings, we use a lot of therapeutic language. And we refer to it sometimes as obsession. But the concept is as old as humanity itself. It's a condition where the will becomes enslaved by something it wants. The mind becomes enslaved by that desire. And the body becomes enslaved because our souls are messed up. And the ultimate reality behind human dissatisfaction is that sinful souls have been cut off from God that we were made to rest in. That's why we're dissatisfied all the time. Now, getting whatever I want, and this is kind of a paradox, but getting whatever I want will seem to gratify myself, but it'll destroy my soul if all I am is about just getting what I want, because I want to please myself. But my soul was made for God. So I want to spend the rest of the message actually looking at how do I pursue a satisfied soul? And there's a series of observations. The first observation I want to make is, I must acknowledge and confess, and I start here, my chronic dissatisfaction. I got to be real. Our souls are always craving, never satisfied. The prophet Habakkuk says in chapter 2, and he wrote about sinful man, he says, "Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him. Yea, also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied." This is life in our world. He opens up his soul as wide as hell, and here's what it says, "and is as death, and cannot be satisfied." As a matter of fact, when you go to the book of Revelations, one of the picture of hell It's called the abyss. It's the Greek word abus, and that's where we get the word abyss. And there's a depth to it that's unexplorable, somewhat frightening, can never be filled up. And so what the prophet Habakkuk is saying is that we as people will go after, and as we do that, it leads to kind of a death. Now, I know that sounds a little bit extreme, so I just want to be very concrete for just a few moments. Mass confession time here. This is going to be the interactive portion of the scriptures. Interactive portion. Confession's good for the soul. If you were ever dissatisfied, whiny, cranky, I'm going to actually ask you to raise your hand. Not yet. but let me run through a few categories, and we'll just begin with work. There was a theologian by the name of Drew Carey who says, if you hate your job, there's a support group. It's called Everybody. And there's actually a national organization research over at the University of Chicago. And they found that what were the 10 happiest and the 10 most hated jobs in the world. Anybody want to guess what came out as number one as the happiest job in the world? It's been rated. It's kind of consistent over time, too. Pastor. But come to find out that the 10 least happiest jobs are the ones that are financially the most lucrative, where people are actually going for success and things like that. Kind of interesting in that regard. And I was thinking about that, thinking about pastor being the happiest jobs, because sometimes being a pastor is awesome. And sometimes it's really, really hard. And I went through an experience this year, and I want to share it with you too, because I think it kind of touches on the truth that we're studying today. There was a period of time. This year, I experienced a period of time where I have never been so busy pastoring. And I've never been happier. Physically exhausting. But I was happy in a depth that I cannot quite explain to you. I remember one particular Friday. I'm getting off of work over in the cab. And I got one person in one hospital. One person in a hospital 20 miles. Oh, yeah. One person in a hospital. Then an elderly lady that was in a home right across the street, and then another person over in a hospital up in Gainesville. And I was bouncing, and just the ability, in sad times, but just the ability to minister with people and just talk about the Lord. It fed my soul in ways I'd never experienced. And up until that point, if you had said, what do you like the most about your job? I would have said, I really enjoy proclaiming the good news of the gospel of the work of Jesus Christ. But at that time, I actually liked pastoring more than I liked preaching. And I hadn't looked back. I'm really getting into this whole pastor. It took me 14 years, but that's because I have a sinful soul. But there's something about this. There's something about jobs where you're actually working for the good of other people that leads towards happiness, and jobs where you're actually working towards your own good and your own satisfaction, according to just outside research. It's not satisfying. There's something about our souls because our souls were made for God. So, again, time for mass confession. And Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing better for a person than that he should make his soul good for his work. And this, too, I see, is from the hand of God. And because of sin, we are all dissatisfied about something. So kind of a mass confession. If you have ever been dissatisfied with your work, would you raise your hand? If you've ever been dissatisfied because you're not married, raise your hand. Because you are married, raise your hand. If you've ever been dissatisfied because of your money, your body, your boss, your hairline, your waistline, your bottom line, your neighbor's dog, your car, your relatives, raise your hand. If you've ever been dissatisfied with any aspect of your life or with the life of the person sitting next to you, raise your hand. And just take a look for a second at a bunch of whiny, cranky people we got in this church. I say that because this is a universal condition. We are all dissatisfied. And that's just the nature of sin. We're dissatisfied because we were made for something more. And the paradox of the soul is that it is incapable of satisfying itself, but it is also incapable of living without satisfaction. That's the paradox of the soul. You were made for soul satisfaction. I want you to think about these words, because the soul craves to be loved. The soul craves for significance. The soul craves for safety. And you can only find these things in God, ultimately. That's why the psalmist says, because your love, think about it, because thy loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise thee, and my soul shall be satisfied. And you find this theme of satisfaction and appetite all over the Bible, because the soul craves, because it's meant for God. And the psalmist says, oh, my soul, find rest in God. And a practical word about soul care here, because we want to learn during this series about how to care for our soul. Practical word. Because in our day, we have a lot of what's called self-talk. We all talk to ourselves. It's really important. It's a really important part of the human condition. But in the Bible, you don't see a lot of self-talk. As a matter of fact, in the Bible, you don't see any self-talk. What you see is soul talk. Big difference there. And the difference is that the soul exists in the presence of God. And so you're going to see in the Psalms, and you're going to see elsewhere, people speaking to their soul, because when you speak to your soul, it naturally turns to prayer. Because I'm aware at that moment that God is always present. And when you're frightened, so word about soul care. This week, when you're frightened, when you're dissatisfied, instead of mindless self-talk, speak to your soul. Why are you frightened? Why are you intimidated? Why are you angry? And at one point this week, and I tried this kind of thought experiment, I was dealing with a particularly obnoxious and hostile defense attorney. And I found my ears getting red. I found my blood pressure really just... I found my hands twitching. And then all of a sudden, I just kind of said in my brain, why are you angry, oh my soul? And what was really cool was... my mind almost instantly kind of went into this prayer. And I felt my blood pressure go down and my body relax. And my ability to interact with this person, this Philistine, so much easier. I challenge you this week, when you face a particular problem or a temptation, do some soul talk. Second point I'd like to ask you to do is kind of practice surrendering the need to always get what you think you want. Jesus says that, again, this is part of the paradox of the soul. If I aim my life at pleasing myself, I actually will destroy my soul. Whereas if I aim my life at pleasing God above pleasing myself, then my soul will find true satisfaction. And things have been like this for thousands of years. Jesus says, this is 2,000 years ago, Jesus says, Matthew chapter 16, verse 25, for whomsoever shall save his life shall lose it. And whomsoever shall lose his life for my sake will save it. For what profiteth a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? In other words, the soul desires a life. The soul that desires a life that is more about satisfaction and desires, it's going down. In other words, I will never achieve satisfaction if I pursue that, if I make my goal about achieving satisfaction. There's a wonderful psalm with a great picture of this. It's Psalm 131, and it says, the psalmist says, Lord, my heart is not haughty, nor my eyes lofty. Neither do I exercise myself in matters or in things too high for me. Surely I have behaved and quieted myself as a child that is weaned of its mother. My soul is even as a weaned child. Now, how do you wean a child? Mothers know this. And you wean a child by strategic disappointment. It's not just cold turkey all at once. You wean a child, you just deliberately withhold from a child at times what a child wants, so that it can be so it can learn to be the master and not the slave of its own little appetites. And the psalmist is encouraging us to do the same thing. The psalm says, my soul is becoming like that. It's not constantly troubling me, but I'm learning that my soul can be satisfied with God, even with all the appetites of my body, with even all the desires of my mind, with even all the choices that I've made. I find that I can actually become the master of it. So again, this week, whenever you get a chance to, practice some strategic disappointment for your souls to gain control over those appetites. Marie and I were in Texas last week, as you all know. Most of you know. Had a friend come on up to me. John, I just want to let you know we're excited about you and Marie coming on out and the kids. We love you all to death. And just I wanted to let you know that I had a great conversation with another brother and sister, and they were just bragging on you and Maria. I'm like, oh, really? What'd they say? You know, because, yeah. Well, they said about Maria, she's fun, she's sweet, she's kind. When she comes into the room, she lights it up, she goes deep, she says the hard things that nobody wants to say, and that when people are around her, they just want to be better. Great. And they said about you, you work well within your limitations. What? I want what she's getting. My soul was dissatisfied, you know. A couple of weeks ago, a friend got a promotion. Two friends, they were vying for the same position. One of them got a promotion that the other one had been seeking just as well. And I watched that other friend actually throw a congratulatory party for the one that beat him out. That's a good soul. That's a good soul. Another thing that's happened to me over the course of this year alone is a very close friend and I have been pursuing a similar objective, and a dear friend of mine has been trying to pursue a position which I, over the course of my career, have expressed interest in. And as he was pursuing it, I knew that it would be in his best interest for me not to pursue it. So I squelched my desire. Something really interesting happened. There were times when I would just kind of flare up for just a little bit, but I'd squelch it down because of my love for my friend. And I have found a happiness in doing that that I don't find by competing. It's not 100% in me because we all have sinful souls. But it's getting easier and easier to pursue the happiness for my friend. One of the books I read about, you know, on the soul, one of the suggestions was, because we live, if you really want to experience the flow of love as never before, the next time you're in a competitive situation, it recommended the next time you're in a competitive situation, actively pray for the success of the other person or the other team, that God could be glorified, and not just that you'll beat them out. That is so foreign to me. Praying for Georgia Tech? I can't fathom it. But you get the point. You work for the other person. Now, the third point is that the soul is more satisfied, and it kind of flows into this. The soul is actually more satisfied when it's less self-preoccupied. My soul actually becomes alive. This is from the prophet Isaiah. Ho, everyone that thirsteth. And that's the human race, and that's a human condition. Ho, everyone that thirsteth. Because thirst is a picture of somebody that desires some water. Ho, everyone that thirsteth. He that hath no money, come ye, buy, and eat. Yea, come buy wine and milk without money and without price. That's grace. Wherefore do ye spend money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfies not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight and fatness. Now, to be thirsty is to be satisfied with is to be driven by unsatisfied desires. And God is saying the wrong approach to soul thirst is through human achievement, human acquisition, human looks, so that soul satisfaction is not about me acquiring the right things, but soul satisfaction is about me acquiring the right soul. The soul that is not obsessed with myself and getting what I want. Really interesting phrase here. Really interesting phrase. Psalm 22. It says, "Deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog." And a little bit later it says, "Recuse my soul from their destructions, my darling from the loins." Another translation, as a matter of fact, a lot of other translations, that phrase "darling" is actually translated "precious." Does that name ring a bell for anybody? Lord of the Rings? As a matter of fact, the word there is used, the Hebrew word is golem, which Tolkien actually used when he was writing word, because back years ago, that word was kind of the ultimate picture, the epitome of the unsatisfied soul. And you know from Lord of the Rings that Gollum was that crazy little character who had his ring precious. And even though he had it, even though he had everything that he ever wanted, he still was an unsatisfied soul, because then he started to fear that he would lose it. Somebody else would get it. And he was just driven mad with it. Everybody has to fight this. And there are some also amazing words over in Exodus chapter 23, verse 9. Exodus chapter 23, verse 9. God says to his people, "Also thou shalt not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart," and that's the word soul, "you know the soul of a stranger, seeing you are strangers in the land of Egypt." Now everybody in this ancient world, the idea was you're going to embrace the other, the stranger, because you know their soul. And God is telling us that he wants us to relate with other people. Because have you ever had someone who just irritated your very soul? Well, God is saying, he's saying, everybody has a soul. Philistines and Israelites. Presidents. Prostitutes, Democrats and Republicans, black people, white people. Matter of fact, there's an author by the name of W.E.B. Du Bois, and he wrote a book about 100 years ago, and it was called The Souls of Black Folks. And it was probably one of the most profound writings on racism and humanity in the 20th century. And notice he didn't call it the selves of black folks. Because we tend to demean people when we don't see them as having souls. The souls of black folks. We forget that they have souls. We forget that there is a depth and a dignity to them. A soul is a person that existing before God, and God is calling the Israelites and he's calling us to deal with other people as they exist before God. Whether it's your husband or your wife. I was talking about this with a friend, and he just took that opportunity to remind me that even Florida football team has souls. Tiny, cramped, ugly little souls that cry out for connection. When I deal with the blue and the orange, I have to deal with them as if they have souls. Have to. Think about the most irritating person that you know of right now. If you deal with them as if you're dealing with a soul, it's going to change the way that you deal with them. If Christians alone would start to do this, within a generation, this world would be changed for the better. If Christians alone, accusations of hypocrisy would cease. And the church would experience growth that we hadn't seen since Pentecost. Just dealing with people on the level that God calls us to deal with them on. We see amazing words in the Bible. Over in 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 1, we're told that the soul of Jonathan became attached to the soul of David. He loved David as he loved his own soul. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him that much. And there was a depth of relationship there that is a million miles away from some of the relationships that we know of and we think of. On a practical note, does anybody love you like that? Like Jonathan loved David? Does anybody care for your soul like that? A place where you could say, or if they don't, you can just pray, God, would you please give me a soul friend like I can love, like Jonathan loved David? I'd like that, God. Would you just teach me that this week? Now, there's one last observation I'd like to make. And if I have lost your attention, if you would give it back to me. Because the ultimate issue in the universe is not my satisfaction. If I have lost your attention, please give it back. The ultimate issue in this universe is not my satisfaction. The ultimate issue is God's satisfaction. Over in Luke chapter 12, the Lord related a story about this man who thought that he had found the secret to satisfaction. He had acquired a lot of stuff, and then he had a windfall. It just collapsed. In Luke chapter 12, verse 19, it says, "Soul, thou hast much goods." He's talking to himself. "Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, be merry." But God said unto him, "Thou fool, thy soul this night shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided?" A lot of interesting stuff going on in this story right here. But what I want to focus on is this part of the story that Jesus says, "Your soul shall be required of thee." And he's actually using very technical financial language. Because there is a word that they would use when a loan would become due. It is required. And Jesus is actually saying, your soul is not your soul. Your soul is on loan from God. It's been given to you, and when you die, it's going to become due because all souls belong to God. They were made for God. That's why they're thirsty, and sin makes me thirsty, but we can't solve that thirst. Matter of fact, Psalm 42, and we sing this hymn, Psalm 42:1 says, "As thirst the heart for water brooks, so thirsts my soul for thee." One day we find out that at the cross, Jesus did something very interesting. And what happened at the cross to Jesus is sometimes talked about as what's known as the doctrine of satisfaction. And the idea is that our sinful souls can never, ever satisfy God's demand for holiness and righteousness and judgment. And they just can't. So God sent his Son. And these are the words of Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53. "He shall see the travail of his soul, and he shall be satisfied. And by his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities." After the suffering of his soul. Real interesting thing. We see this in Mark chapter 8. We also see it. It's also conveyed in Matthew. Jesus is at Gethsemane, and he says unto him, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death." On the cross, Jesus, who is God with us, suffered not just in his body, but in his soul to the very depths of his being. And he was satisfying his demands for justice and holiness and righteousness because his soul was perfect. One day Jesus is going to come back. And there's a line that I love from that hymn. This is my Father's rule. "Jesus who died shall be satisfied, and earth and heaven shall be one." One day Jesus is coming. One day souls are going to be required. And he is setting everything right. And this is the good news part of the sermon. When Jesus comes, he has done what is necessary to set everything right. And God is going to look, and God is going to be satisfied. I remember back in 1999, I had to go away on a business trip. I actually had to fly out of town. Olivia was 3 and Julia was 1, and I remember distinctly, I actually had the thought, it's the first time I've been gone for that much time, and I wonder if Julia will kind of remember me and recognize me when I get back. I know, silly thought, but that's just the way I was. Now, back in 1999, that's pre-September 11th, and y'all remember those time periods where you could actually come up to the gate of the airline. You could bring BB guns and hacksaws right up to the plane. I mean, it was just... And I remember that Maria brought Olivia and Julia up. She had Olivia by her hand who was doing something. She was holding Julia, and I came off the plane, and my thought was, I wonder. And when I stepped off into the concourse, and I see Julia's little face just light up, and she threw up her hands, and she said, "Daddy!" And I thought to myself, she knows me. There is a passage in 1 John chapter 3. It says, "Beloved, now we are the sons of God. It doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him. For we shall see him as he is." One day your soul is going to become due. One day the Father will return. And every child of God that Jesus has chosen will know him. It doesn't yet appear. We've got that constant dissatisfaction that's going on. But the ultimate issue is not our satisfaction. The ultimate issue is God's satisfaction. And Isaiah tells us, he shall see the travail of his soul, and he shall be satisfied. It's not up to you. It wasn't up to you. Ultimately and always, it was up to Jesus. And we serve a gracious God. And it doesn't yet appear because we're in this earth in mortal bodies and we are in a sin-filled world. But when he comes, when we see him, we are going to throw up our arms and we're going to go, "Daddy." And we shall see him as he is, satisfied.